Anne. But before I start on that, I'll just say a little bit about the geometrical significance of that Lie bracket. So I think I sort of very briefly sketched it at the end of yesterday's lecture. So the notion of what happens with the Lie bracket, we said it was a commutator, or I claimed it was a commutator, and you could write it in terms of the commutator of vectors acting on a function in C infinity of n. And so this notion of one first doing one tangent vector, then the other, and subtracting the reverse process sort of gives us this clue that if I have here sort of two vector fields, U and V, sort of has this idea that here I do a tangent with V, then U. Here I do it first U, then V. And it's saying that maybe these two need not be the same thing. So this is simply what I'm going to demonstrate now. I'm just going to label my diagram the right way to make sure. So the claim is that the commutator represents the degree by which our two vector fields don't sort of commute. So in this case, if we were trying to set up a coordinate system, for example, then trying to do it based on these vector fields would not be a good move because we would not have a unique labeling of coordinates. So if we go here a distance s along v and a distance t along u, it depends which way around we do it. So the label st would not actually work as a label for coordinates. And my claim is that this quantity along there is going to be s times t times the commutator of u and v. And of course, then the converse is true. If I have coordinates and then I consider the vectors that are formed by d by dx for each of those coordinates, then the Lie bracket of these vectors will vanish. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start off at the origin here. This is like x0. And then I'm going to calculate my coordinates of each of these points, A, B, C, and D, and then I'm going to subtract D from B and see what I get. So here I'm very much using the underlying structure, the Rn structure of the manifold. I'm saying that although these points are living in my manifold, I've kind of transported them from a chart into my underlying Rn, and I'm using this coordinate patch, the x mu coordinate patch. I'm starting off at the image of O, and I know I've got my vector field V, and then I'm simply doing a Taylor expansion around O to get to A, and I'm going to order of my small quantity S or T squared because that is where I'm claiming that this effect shows up. So obviously the first bit's fairly straightforward. You just move a little bit along V naught, but then the correction to that is that half S squared piece. So then I've gone now from O to A. I want to go from A to B, so I have to move along U there. So that means I have to know what my vector field U is at the point A. So I have to say, what's my U at A? And I do that again by a Taylor expansion, expanding around the origin. So my U at A is U at the origin plus this correction S. So that's kind of, this is our basic type of expression that we're going to need. So now let me just do this. I'm going to calculate my position, my coordinates at D, and then I'm going to subtract the coordinates at B. So if I look.
Do you expand it in the same way with the half a square?
Because I'm not going to need that in the end. Because each time my vector field comes in, it's already come in at order. If we call these epsilons, our S and T epsilons, yeah. It only, my vector field starts coming in at order epsilon. So I only ever need to expand it to order epsilon to get me out to order epsilon squared.
Okay, so yeah.
So I mean, this is just saying this. These are the two relations I'm using. So to get to xd, so to get to d, I've got to jump across from c. So xd is going to be xc plus, in this case, I've moved again along v. So that's just applying my first relation, having hopped from C to D. And so now I look here and I see, okay, I need my V at C, and that's why that's already appearing at order epsilon, okay? So the first thing I do is I ask, what is my X at C? So again, I use this first relation, but instead of having V's and S's, I've gone from, to get from O to C, I've gone along U. So I have to replace V with U and S with T. So that's my first term. So the second term, I've got to have V at C. So again, I use this. But of course, I've replaced my S with T, and I've kind of swapped my U's and V's here. So that's my V at C. And then when I look at my order S squared piece, all I need is the value of V at the origin, because it's already order epsilon squared. So I've simply gone through and replaced each of these terms in turn. The first term is the first line, the second term is the first bit of the second line, and the last term is just V at naught. So that's what the coordinates are at D. And then if I want to get the coordinates at B, all I've done to get to D is to go first along U, then V. So B is going to be first along V, then U. So all I do is I say I replace every time I see a U here, I swap my U's and V's, and I swap my S's and T's. So that's doing the swap on the first line. And then on the second line. So that's my coordinates at the point B. So if I ask now, what is that connecting vector from BD, B to D, well, you can see that the x naughts cancel, the linear terms are the same in each, we've got tu plus sv in each case. And then if we look at the quadratic terms, in both of the expressions, we've got a half t squared u du and a half s squared v dv, so they cancel. And so all I'm left with is st into, well, on the top line I've got u dv, and then minus v du. So that is indeed the expression for uv at the point O. So just by using the underlying Rn structure, doing a Taylor expansion, we see that our commutator really is just telling us about how, you know, things don't close if we go along different vector fields.
Is that necessarily related to a curvature?
No. It's just telling you something about the vector fields, about whether or not they kind of close off. So typically, you know, when you choose coordinate systems, you're quite used to these things vanishing. What we're going to see as we move on to talking about curvature is that it's whether or not you have a basis that has vanishing Lie brackets impacts on the individual components of the curvature. So it's something that's... it's just a property of your vector fields. It's related to whether or not you can use your vector fields to set up a coordinate system. Mm-hmm. If you have a set of vector fields, which close under a Lie bracket, and that's sort of so subalgebra, if you like, then that's an indicator that you can use properties, you know, use the vectors to form a coordinate system.
So it's about the existence of such vector fields. The curvature. I mean, for example, on the two sphere, mm-hmm. we cannot use altitude and latitudes because they don't close.
Sorry, the. You mean longitude and latitude?
Yeah.
That's a good coordinate system. Because we use it.
But it doesn't close.
Yes, it does. I mean, we have a unique labeling of latitude and longitude for where we are on the Earth.
I meant it depends on path, like when we first go at this, or...
Yeah, but if I draw the Earth, right? Well, I draw a sphere, let's say. And I go along a line of... Oh, I always get them mixed up. That's longitude, isn't it? I go along a line of longitude. I go along a line of latitude. I go up a line of longitude. And then along, let's say, a line of latitude to get back. That's closed.
You came back shorter.
Yeah, that doesn't matter. Because it's the same. These are the same. You know, this is the same... you're still going between here, you're still going between the same values of latitude, and along these lines, you're still along the same values of longitude. So if you can assign a unique label, then that means that your vectors do indeed commute. So it's saying nothing about length, because you can do Lie derivatives without a metric. And it's actually it's not really saying anything about curvature either, because, I mean, here, obviously, the space is curved. But again, you know, I'm sure if I were sufficiently perverse, I'm sure I can think of vector fields that don't commute on R squared or something. But it's simply a statement about the properties of the vector fields. And we're about to use it, or at least to see this cropping up, when we talk about the connection. So The only other thing I did want to remind you of, which I know David did mention, I just want to remind you of this relation. And that is a relation between Lee and Dean. So just as a reminder notationally, this is sort of using your Brahe and Kett notation to say this two form is being contracted with these two vectors in turn, U and V. And on the right-hand side, omega with V, that's a contraction, so it's a scalar, it's a function, it's an element of C infinity of M. So the vector U operates on C infinity of M, so that's U of that function minus V of this function. And then this is the contraction of omega with the Lie bracket of U and V. So that's just a relation that we're about to make use of. So again, you will have seen a lot about the covariant derivative in the first part, or the introductory part of GR. So we're just going to kind of go over it a little bit again, but from this slightly more abstract perspective, and using this different perspective, we're going to derive what are called Cartan structural equations. So this is a different way of getting to curvature using the language of forms. And in practice, if you're calculating a sort of generic curvature tensor, if you want to do a computation where you don't want to fix the dimension, you don't necessarily want to fix your coordinates, this can be a very useful way, an efficient way of calculating curvature. So if you have a very specific metric, then my advice is use a computer program. But if you want to start looking for patterns and develop intuition, or you're looking for sort of more general structure, then my advice would be to use Cartan. So, so the covariant derivative works by giving additional structure to your manifold. So you take your tangent bundle and you add a connection to it, or literally a way of connecting neighboring tangent spaces. So you're giving a rule of how the vector spaces link together. So you're kind of saying, well, my vector here transports to this vector in this tangent space over here. And so we define our connection by acting with the covariant derivative grad on a basis vector. So here, I'm assuming that I have a basis in my tangent space at each point P. Grad is my derivation. And so I'm saying that I have at each tangent space has some basis, set a little basis EA. omega A is the dual basis. So what that means, in fact, is it's dual to the basis EA, which means that if I take omega A and contract it with EB, I get the delta, Kronecker delta. So we can also write our connection component simply as a sort of contraction of various derivatives. So that's how we would define our connection, and our grad, again, one of these very kind of abstract definitions, but basically, a derivation, again, we're seeing this thing crop up all the time. A derivation is Leibnizian. If you take a derivation on two quantities, you get a sum of the derivation on the first times the second plus the first times the derivation of the second. It reduces to d on functions, so that's kind of anchoring it with what we know as a derivation or a derivative. And the fact it commutes with contractions is kind of saying that it's sort of respecting our sort of overall tensor structure on the manifold. And then the connection coefficients are really just what comes along with this particular derivation in this particular basis. So you can have all sorts of different possible derivations on a manifold which correspond to different ways of connecting the tangent spaces together. In practice, all we really need to know about is what we call a metric connection, because that's the one we use in gravity. So in gravity, we use what we call a torsion-free, and I'm about to be a bit more precise about that, but it's essentially symmetric, more or less. And it's a metric connection. So what that means is that if we take grad and act on g, which is our sort of distance function, we get zero. Torsion is almost the anti-symmetric part of a connection. So here you see that I'm taking grad u of v minus grad v of u, so that's like taking an anti-symmetric part of the connection. But it's not quite that. You have to subtract off a Lie bracket of u and v if it's there. So that's the only thing I'm not as sure that you've seen. So why is it almost the anti-symmetric part? If I want to get the components of T, I sort of slot in basis vectors here. So my T is the anti-symmetric part of my connection, as I would expect, plus the extra piece. Which is telling me whether or not my basis closes, whether it's formed out of one of these coordinate systems. So these things here are called the structure constants. Of the basis, EA. So that's really why I just wanted to say a bit more about the Lie derivative and talk about what the geometric significance is. Because whereas usually when we're doing sort of classical, normal, just, you know, common garden gravity, we're simply interested in space-times. We often use coordinate bases, you know, like TR, theta, phi. And so we tend to not really spot these extra pieces coming in our relation for the Riemann tensor, for example. However, if you're doing something like, if you want instead to do supergravity or you want to look at spinners on space-time, you have to tend not to use coordinate systems, you tend to use orthonormal bases. And an orthonormal basis typically does not have this vanishing Lie bracket. So technically, that's why you tend to find these extra pieces cropping up. So let's move on to see what this Cartan formalism is. So we take our connection components and we make a one form out of them by contracting on what I would label here B is like the differential, what I would call the differentiating index. In other words, if you kind of look at what's the index here that's representing the derivation grad? Well, here we've got a vector. Grad is like giving you a covector. So what's the covector part here? It's omega A, and the A index comes first. So it's like the differentiating index. So we mop that index up, and we form this one form here. So you'll sometimes actually also see this theta labeled as an omega. So usually if you're doing spinners, you will actually call this an omega. And I'm just calling it theta, I guess, because that's what I'm used to, but also it distinguishes it from the covector basis. So here you've got a different symbol labeling the vectors, the covectors, and the spin connection. So what this allows us to do, or what you'll see, the other place you'll see this cropping up is when you take covariant derivatives of spinners. So I was saying before that typically you used an orthonormal basis. In fact, there's a theorem that says that you can only put spinners on spacetime if you have, or if you can construct a global orthonormal basis. And so once you can do that, you've got your spin connection. You then use your spin connection together with gamma matrices to construct the sort of the equivalent of the covariant derivative for spin half particles. So what does Cartan do? Thank you. it relates the torsion to the spin connection and derivatives of the covector basis. And what it does in practice is gives a very efficient way of calculating the connection, because rather than have a sort of symbol where you've got all the indices and you go through on a case-by-case basis calculating the individual components, instead you sort of have your basis of forms, you do exterior differentiation, which is actually reasonably straightforward, and you sort of carry a lot of information along with you as you go along, and you end up with much less of this, well, I've got to check A equals 1, B equals 2, C equals 3 type of way of calculating. So in order to calculate the connection, which is essentially boiling down to calculating these one forms, what we need are a couple of pieces of information. So the first piece of information since I've said that Cartan relates torsion to spin connection, torsion, that relation for our torsion is picking out anti-symmetric things, picking out things that are anti-symmetric in B and C. So it doesn't tell me, if I know what a torsion is, it's not going to give me information on the symmetric part of the connection. So what I've first got to do is to figure out what is the symmetric part of my connection, and then I'll look at the rest. So this is my first step, which is saying, this is how I get the symmetric part of the connection. So let's just prove this. So I'll start by looking at what is D of GAB. Well, GAB are the components of G in the vector, in the basis of EA, EB. So here I've got D of G contracted with EA, EB. So this is where we are definitely not using abstract index notation. GAB are scalars, and so this is how we find them. We act with our covector, cotensor G, on the basis EA, EB. Now I use the fact that on functions, D is grad. So that's my first manipulation. Then I use the fact that grad commutes with contractions to pull grad inside. I use the fact it's Leibnizian to take its action on each of these three in turn. And then the fact that it's the metric connection to say that grad G is zero, to say that this is equal to G acting on grad EA and EB plus G EA and grad EB. So if you can't see, it'll go up in a minute. But then I know that if I look right over to where I defined the connection, grad of EA is just giving me my connection coefficients. Let's just make sure I get my... Just write it down, put it up, and then I'll talk through it. Yes.
Yeah, I'm getting a little bit confused with the graph, because we defined it for basis vectors there, and now we're using it as a function.
Okay, so we actually, grad is a derivation. So actually, in the end, the grad is defined on the bottom line on the right-hand side of that board. So it's a derivation that, you know, is therefore Leibnizian, reduces to D, and commutes with contractions. So this is just all we need our covariant derivative to do. Now, whether or not it's a metric connection, you know, depends. It doesn't have to be. So we're only ever interested in metric connections, but in fact, you can have all sorts of different connections, potentially, on a manifold. So, you know, so it's not that there is a unique covariant derivative on a manifold. We're interested in a specific one, which is unique once we've said it's got to be a metric connection and it's got to be torsion-free. So then we know our connection is unique because that's the one that corresponds to what we're interested in physics, which is distances, space-time observables. So our connection is unique. But from a mathematical perspective, all that we require is a consistent way of linking together our tangent spaces. And that is, you know, that's the structure that mathematicians would call a covariant derivative. Once we've got a grad, that's our connection. So either from our perspective, we'd say, okay, I've got my gammas, I've got my connection coefficients, so now I know how to do a covariant derivative. Whereas, so that's kind of why I wrote it that way round. Whereas mathematicians would start with what is the property of a covariant derivative, and then say what the connection components are. So, yeah. So we kind of start more from the perspective of I've got these connection components. This defines my covariant derivative. That makes sense.
Yep. But it's a map from where to where then? So our NABLA is a map from, so for example, if I have a function, it will give me a 1.
Yeah. And if you have a vector, it gives you a mixed tensor.
Okay.
Yeah, so it always adds a covariant index, if you like. Yeah. It always adds a covector part. So it takes you from whatever tensor space you started with to the same tensor space, tensor T star, PP star of M.
Okay.
So that's what it does, yeah. So it's that map that's a derivation, i.e. satisfies these various properties, yeah.
Okay.
So, yeah. And so here, this is really just a fairly straightforward use of the definition. You know, at each point, we've started off by saying, what's GAB? It's the components, they're scalars. So on scalars, D and grad are the same, so I use that on the top line. I then use the other properties over here. It commutes with contractions and is Leibnizian. I've used that to get to the second line, plus the fact it's a metric connection. So I've said grad G is 0. So at this point, to the second line, all I have done is use the three properties, mathematical properties of grad. I then carry on to sort of say, well, okay, now I use the definition of these connection coefficients to pull out, and I pull these out because they're just scalars. They have no tensorial properties. They're sets of scalars. So I pull them out, and then I look, what have I got here? Well, this is just the definition of the components of G in the basis, E and omega. So these are the components of G times the one form, connection one form, and components of G times another connection one form. And so indeed it picks out the symmetric part of the connection. Now indeed you should have expected it to be symmetric because one of the things we say with the metric is it is a symmetric bilinear form. So it has to be symmetric, what's on the right-hand side. And all we've done is said, well, actually, it's the symmetric part of our connection. So if, for example, we took an orthonormal basis, that means we've chosen our basis vectors and covectors such that the metric is components are either 1 or minus 1. So in an orthonormal basis, my scalars, my metric G, the components of my metric, are either plus or minus 1. Therefore, D of G is 0 because it's a constant. G is just a set of constants. If D of G is 0, then the symmetric part of theta, our connection, one form, vanishes. So that tells us our theta AB is anti-symmetric. So in an orthonormal basis, we're kind of now reducing the number of components that we would have to calculate in our connection because we've said, okay, it's anti-symmetric. So if we've got four dimensions, then that means there's only six independent different components of theta AB for each, for the one, you know, for the connection one forms. So to get to Cartan's first structural equation, what I'm going to do is just consider this particular combination. Okay? So if I write out the definition of my connection one form, all I see here is it's my connection coefficients times a wedge product of the dual basis elements. Now this is, I mean, it's a two-form, but you can see that it's anti-symmetric on B and C because these are the same basis elements. So just for the moment, in what looks like just a formal rewriting, I'm saying, okay, so I'm going to explicitly take the anti-symmetric part of gamma in here. So this is all about determining the anti-symmetric part of the connection. So now I sort of go up two boards, and I spot that in my definition of torsion, I've got this anti-symmetric part of the connection. So I can replace this with a half T plus these structure constants. So this says anti-symmetric, I'm sort of trying to peel off the anti-symmetric part of the connection, it says my one forms wedged with my basis are giving me the torsion and the structure constants. So this is just simply the definition of my structure constants. And this first term is just what we call the torsion two form, which is the combination of TABC with omega B cross omega C.
Didn't we want it to be torsion free, like the metric?
That's right. At the moment, I'm deriving Cartan's structural equation in generality. So these are the two pieces of information that we're going to need to calculate our connection. The first one is just saying for a metric connection that DG gives me the symmetric part of the connection. So that's tick, I can do the symmetric bit. Now I'm hunting the anti-symmetric bit. And so what I'm doing is doing a bit of manipulation. At the moment, I'm being agnostic. I'm going to derive a general equation, which is what Cartan did. And then I'm going to set t equal to 0 when I want to do a calculation of our connection. Yep. So this is finding actually Cartan's structure, you know, what the calculation that Cartan did, rather than just, you know, what we want. Yep.
Quick question, what do you use the underlying notation for? Anything that is not scalar?
So it's to emphasize it's not a scalar, yeah, but to emphasize that it has some tensor structure. So if I was typesetting this, I'd use boldface. Yeah. So it's emphasizing it's a geometric object that's not a scalar. The indices here are saying that there's not just one of these, there's n of them. So they're mixed. They've got a mixed nature. They've got both a geometric aspect to them as well as a bookkeeping aspect to them. So now I'm going to use that relation that I asked you to recall. So I'm going to take the relation d omega with uv, and I'm going to insert covector basis and vector basis. Literally just rewritten that relation, but having inserted the basis vectors or covectors in there. Now this here is just the Kronecker delta, and so it's a set of constants. So when I act on it with my vector, operate on it, it gives me 0. Same here. And so I end up just with this piece that I wanted, because that's what is cropping up on the last line of my expression over there. So coming back over here, it's saying that I can replace this combination here with minus d omega eb ec. But then this is just taking the components, the BC components of my two form, d omega, and making them back into a two form. So in fact, this whole thing is minus d omega a. So these are the components of the these are the components of the two-form d omega. And so a half components omega cross omega is just back to d omega. So hence we get Cartan's first structural equation, which relates the, tells us about the anti-symmetric part of the connection. So if we're torsion-free, we calculate our connection components by taking d of omega a. Okay, and then we know what our symmetric bit is from dg, and our anti-symmetric bit is d omega. So it's also kind of fitting in this notion that torsion is somehow a separate, I mean, it's we don't consider torsion usually in gravity, but if we wanted to, it would be a separate piece of physical information. We can't get it from the metric. We have to put something extra in. So our connection would be d symmetric bits given by dg, anti-symmetric bits given by d omega, plus torsion, if we have torsion.
That's only because you set your metric to be this way in the first place. Like, if you don't require the metric to be torsion-free in the first place, then it wouldn't be a separate notion, right?
Sorry, if we don't require?
The metric to be torsion-free in the first place when you have to take gradient of g.
Yeah, if we didn't require that. No, but then we still have to input t. So t is a separate field. It's an additional field that we have to prescribe. Regardless of the metric, in the sense, if we want to know what is our connection, what is grad, the symmetric bit's given by dg, if we have a metric connection. The anti-symmetric bit is determined by the torsion and the omega. So omega we've got, we have our basis on our manifold, so we can calculate d omega, so we can calculate the first bit there, but then to find gamma, which is hidden away in the theta ac there, we need to also know what t is. So t is like an extra sort of physical field if we choose to put it in. So some people do, I mean, some, you know, but there is a sort of constant stream of, you know, research on, torsion, having torsion with together with the metric, yeah. So. So curvature, just like I think when you were asking the question about longitude and latitude on the sphere, you were thinking more about parallel transport around a closed loop and not coming back to where you started. So that's got, this is where you this is the context in which you're thinking. So here we've got a commutator of covariant derivatives, and that is why it tells us about if we go around a closed curve, you know, let's say we've got one that the Lie bracket actually vanishes, then the covariant derivative tells us about parallel transport. So we parallel transport around one, and then we go the other way around our curve, and we may not end up with the same vector. And if we don't end up with the same vector, that tells us we've got curvature. So our curvature tensor, R, which is the Riemann tensor,
what's exactly the geometrical meaning of the torsion? Because we have...
I didn't really say. Good question. I'm going to have to come back to that one, I think. Let me just get through this last bit. So it's telling you...
You said that he said when you do a parallel transport mm-hmm. over a loop, it's and you don't return to the initial state, it's the curvature, mm-hmm. it's not the holonomy, instead, because this is measure, the holonomy measure, the...
Holonomy is a more general context. Here we're talking specifically about parallel transport of vectors, but with holonomy you could also imagine, like a holonomy of a gauge connection. So it's got a slightly, it's in a more general context. But yes, you're right. That's the other, that is another term that is used, but it's in a more general context. Here we're talking very specifically about the curvature of the connection that's to do with our space-time. So it's context.
Yes.
Yeah.
And there is other question, because all time when you discuss about manifold, and you know that the covariant derivative here, you need to define the tangent bundle, mm-hmm. which goes, it's an onto map from space of sections to manifold.
Mm-hmm.
This is like more general. Are you just talking about more specific, just you are interested because physicists interested about manifold instead of the tangent bundle?
I'm not sure I quite got the question.
No, because you need to define the tangent bundle, and you assign for each point a section.
Yes.
And after that, you take the space of
if you're
sections.
Dealing with the vector field, yeah.
Yes, mm-hmm. that's why. So mm-hmm. just all time I heard manifold instead of tangent bundle.
When I... Quite possibly, I wouldn't. I mean, I'm just not quite sure in the context, where you're asking about this. Mm. It is quite possible that I am using just language, you would have to give me a specific context, and
I
then
understand.
You know, because I can hear that you're asking me about some being precise with something. So I guess I'd, if we go back afterwards, because I think I really need to get finished with this.
No, it's fine.
Then I'll come back afterwards, and then I'll try and be specific, because it's definitely true that when I'm going through this, I've got an agenda, which is that we're trying to describe gravity. You're correct in saying that the way I'm talking about things is with that agenda in mind. So yeah, but. So let me just write down the components of our... So the only thing that might be slightly different in terms of when you typically, first do GR is that last piece. So you're usually doing it in a coordinate basis, so there's no structure constants. If you're in a general basis, you have that last term. So in other words, if your basis vectors don't necessarily commute. So that's the only thing that really changes. And then I'll just state... So Cartan's second structural equation relates curvature to derivatives of connection one forms. Via this relation. Now, if what I'd just like to draw an analogy here is if you have gauge fields, you're doing the standard model, so you're talking about gauge fields, you're talking about non-abelian gauge fields. The curvature of your non-abelian gauge field is dA plus A wedge A in That's your sort of classic curvature of your normal gauge field. I'm just sort of saying structurally, this is got the same structure. Theta here is playing the part of your gauge field. So this is like, and indeed, you know, it is like, it, you know, we know that our connection is not telling us everything about curvature. We have gauge freedom in our connection. The physical thing is the curvature of the connection. We get the curvature by taking d of theta, and then also the theta wedge theta piece, which is like these gamma gamma pieces over here. So it's pretty much doing the same job as what you do when you look at normal gauge fields living on a flat space-time and ask what is the field strength, what's the physical content of my gauge field. So it's the same thing. What's the physical content of my connection? We answer that as curvature, tidal forces, and we get it by taking this proper sort of corrected exterior derivative. So I'll stop there.